From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Republican Senator Ted Cruz loses big in Indiana and drops out.
With a heavy heart, but with boundless optimism for the long-term future of our nation, we are suspending our campaign.
Double-digit winner Donald Trump says he's ready for the general election.
We're going after Hillary Clinton. She will not be a great president. She will not be a good president. She will be a poor president.
A big night for Bernie Sanders.
I understand that Secretary Clinton thinks that this campaign is over. I've got some bad news for her. Tonight, we won a great victory in Indiana.
This hour on Point, how Indiana was won and the road ahead. You can join us on air or online. Did your candidate win or lose in Indiana? Can the Republicans rally around Trump? Are the Democrats ready to rally around Hillary? Still feeling the burn? Join us at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me this hour from New York City is Kelly O'Donnell, Capitol Hill correspondent for NBC News covering the 2016 race. Kelly, welcome back to On Point.
Always great to be with you, especially with you today, Jane.
Oh, thank you, Kelly. And from Indianapolis, Indiana, Eliana Johnson is with us, Washington editor for the National Review. She runs the reporting arm of the publication, which is separate from the editorial side. National Review editors published the Against Trump issue in January. They had endorsed Ted Cruz. Eliana, welcome back to you.
Hi, Jane.
So let's start with the Republicans' huge victory for Donald Trump last night. Are the math and the momentum now in Trump's favor, Kelly O'Donnell?
Oh, very definitely. This was an extraordinary night for Trump, in particular, the margin. Ted Cruz had an opportunity, his campaign thought, in a state like Indiana. He worked very hard there. There were some natural constituencies for him there, and the margin was enormous. Had it been closer, within perhaps a couple of points, we might have seen a different decision from Ted Cruz to press on, to keep fighting through California. But this was, in political terms, a blowout. And so now what we have is Donald Trump taking on the mantle of being the presumptive nominee of the party. We will begin to see some of the structural changes that are critically important for a fall campaign that we haven't seen so far. And by that, I mean expect his campaign to begin to fuse itself with the RNC on certain levels to begin planning the convention. There will also be a big staff up where he will hopefully be able to attract more Republican talent. One of the challenges for Trump, he's been unconventional, highly criticized, and will Republican operatives and staffers at various levels, from entry level to the top minds in the party, be willing to work for Trump in an environment that has included all of this never Trump, not Trump, stop Trump sentiment because of the things he said and the way that he's conducted himself. Mm.
Eliana, does this derail the goal of a contested convention now with Cruz out?
There will not be a contested convention now, and I think it's fair to say that Trump is the presumptive Republican nominee. And I think what Ted Cruz showed last night, dropping out of the race, was that he really was a niche candidate for the far right, for true intellectual conservatives. And his goal was to unite evangelicals and Tea Partiers. And he did that fairly effectively, but that ultimately wasn't a big enough group to carry him to the Republican nomination. And a candidate like Trump, who had a message for a larger group of people and a platform to deliver it with all of the media coverage that he got, ultimately prevailed.
Here he is, Senator Ted Cruz, announcing he was suspending his presidential campaign.
Together, we left it all on the field in Indiana. We gave it everything we've got. But the voters chose another path.
There was Ted Cruz. You know, he put all of his eggs in the Indiana basket, Kelly O'Donnell. He himself said that Indiana was his firewall. Where'd he go wrong? What happened?
Well, I think that this was just not a year where his message resonated. I think that part of Ted Cruz's challenge has always been that he did not have the support of the party in many ways. He has not been a popular figure in Washington. And when you have the populism and the sort of celebrity of Donald Trump and this get tough message that Trump has been campaigning with, when you have the fans fusing with the voter base, it's a different animal in politics. Ted Cruz had a very strong campaign in terms of its organization. He was a disciplined candidate. A lot of things that he did right, but the environment was just not favorable to him this year. And I think he was smart in many ways to realize where the math is, to make a very gracious exit, to be able to, in his sort of concession speech, talk about the ideas that brought him into the campaign to begin with. And that is typically a way to reset, to try to go back to Washington, which won't be easy for Ted Cruz since he has run against Washington, but to have a sort of holding pattern for a future place in the party. He's only 45 years old. He may try to run again in 2020. We'll see what happens. But it just was not his year. Had the anti-Trump movement had a more palatable figure for who the Republican voters are today, we wouldn't be here. But they fielded 17 candidates, many of them with tremendous experience and different points of view in the party, and one after another fell to Trump because he has been able to speak to the anger that is out there and to convince people that he can do something differently that anyone who has been an elected official has not been able to do. And so Trump is on the verge of becoming the first nominee since Dwight Eisenhower, who has never held elective office. That's really an extraordinary thing in what has been a hard-to-believe year.
So, Eliana Johnson, tell us about the delegate count. Where is it now? Where does Donald Trump stand?
Trump has now over 1,100 delegates, and he is right within clinching the 1,237 majority that he needs to capture the nomination, which he will do in the coming weeks as the race moves to West Virginia, Nebraska, and out west. And so we'll see him officially become the presumptive nominee before he's nominated July in Cleveland. And I think what Kelly said is absolutely right. But I would add that Cruz earning the enmity of the Republican establishment was absolutely essential to his brand and of earning the support of the voters who were his most passionate fans. And so ultimately, he ended up as the last man standing against Trump and thought that some of his enemies would come around, and he proved wrong in that calculation, which ultimately cost him some trouble in the end. But I think he did think that if it was between him and Trump at the end, some of the senators whose enmity he had earned would choose him over Trump, and that proved wrong.
On the Democratic side, a win for Bernie Sanders in Indiana. Here he is speaking with reporters last night after winning the state's Democratic primary. He looked ahead with optimism.
As more and more delegates to the Democratic convention take a hard look at which candidate is generating the kind of enthusiasm, excitement, voter turnout that we need to make sure that somebody like a Donald Trump does not become president, I think you're going to see more and more delegates concluding that candidate is Bernie Sanders.
Kelly O'Donnell, Clinton still has a significant delegate lead. I mean, what did this win mean for the Democratic race?
Well, I think what's so different about the Democratic race versus what we saw play out with Republicans is that the insurgent candidate, Bernie Sanders, has a massive groundswell of energized voters who want him to continue. He has been able to raise extraordinary sums. The most recent reporting, he was down a little bit, but still raised $26 million. More than $200 million has come in. So he has been able to tap into the liberal grassroots and to mobilize. He likes to call it a movement, and that's a fair assessment in that he has energized and brought new people into the party. That's so different than what we saw on the Republican side, where there was this sort of anti-Trump movement that could not galvanize around one figure, could not get the momentum. And so with Sanders, he is keeping this race something that you can argue is credible to the next state and all the way to California. From Sanders' perspective, giving Democratic voters a chance to choose between himself and Secretary Clinton is important. Clinton can clearly argue that she is very far ahead, prohibitively ahead, and will be the nominee. But this also puts her in a position where on the primary night, she could have been juxtaposed with Donald Trump as the two official presumptive nominees. And she didn't get that. And so in a momentum way, in sort of an optics way, Bernie Sanders was able to chip away at Hillary Clinton again through success. She has favorable territory ahead of her, and she is going to try to pivot to focus on Donald Trump. But she could have had a clearer path had he not prevailed last night, even though they knew that Indiana was going to be good territory for Bernie Sanders. The Clinton team could have had a better showing. That didn't happen. They pressed forward, ultimately confident they become the standard bearer of the Democratic Party. But this was just another example of how Bernie Sanders has changed the race on the Democratic side.
Eliana Johnson, I mean, she largely abandoned Indiana, really, after polls showed her faring very poorly with a predominantly white electorate. How do you see Hillary after Indiana?
Yeah, you know, these working class white voters have proved to be an enormous weak spot for Hillary Clinton and young voters as well. And I think it will be the same way going forward. She undoubtedly will become the Republican nominee, but what we're really seeing Democratic nominee. But what we're really seeing is, as on the Republican side, an enormous ideological struggle on the Democratic side between, essentially the Democratic socialism of Bernie Sanders and the more moderate, I would say, Democratic Clintonism of the 1990s, as embodied by Hillary Clinton, who's tried to make various modifications to that ideology. But even though there's been a more bitter fight on the Republican side, I think we're seeing something similar play out on the Democratic side. And though Hillary Clinton is very likely to prevail, it does seem that the energy and the enthusiasm is behind Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. Eliana Kelly, hold on. I got to go to break here. We'll be right back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the wins of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders in Indiana and how the general election is shaping up now. You can join the conversation. What did all the experts miss that you understand about this election? Are you ready for Trump? Still saying never? We're speaking this hour with Kelly O'Donnell of NBC News and Eliana Johnson of the National Review. Joining me now from Washington is Representative Tom Marino, U.S. Representative for Pennsylvania's 10th Congressional District. He has endorsed Donald Trump for president. Tom Marino, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hello.
Hello. Also in Washington, Rory Cooper is with us, Republican strategist, advisor to the Never Trump PAC. Rory Cooper, welcome to you.
Hi, Jane.
So, Tom Marino, I'll start off with you. You've endorsed Donald Trump. How are you feeling coming off his win last night, a big win in Indiana?
Feeling very good. I was pleased with Indiana. We thought that's the way it was going to go. And now Donald is the presumptive Republican candidate.
How do you think having Trump as the nominee will impact the Republican Party broadly?
I think the Republican Party will come together. I've seen in the past where I've had candidates that I supported and didn't win and was upset about it and angry, but realized and stepped back and looked at the bigger picture that anything's better than Hillary Clinton.
Rory, the Never Trump PAC was big. I mean, has Never Trump turned into Probably Trump, a new movement now?
No, Never Trump still means Never Trump. Never Trump was never going to be Maybe Trump. And listen, it gives me no joy to be here saying that today. I'd much rather be focused on defeating Hillary Clinton. But we also have an obligation to speak up when somebody does not reflect the values and the principles of the Republican Party or the positions of it, as a matter of fact. And, you know, when I can't allow my children to be in the same room as Donald Trump being on television because of what might come out of his mouth, I think that Republicans should stand up for the values of conservatism. And if that means having difficult choices to make, then that's what we're going to have to do. But Donald Trump does not reflect the Republican Party I spent 25 years working for, and will continue to make that clear.
The Never Trump PAC was actively working to take votes away from Donald Trump in Indiana. You spent a lot of money. I'm looking at the graph here. Anti-Trump or pro-Cruz money totaled about $6 million to Trump's $900,000 spent. I mean, what happened? Voters clearly are not agreeing with you.
Well, listen, clearly the outside groups can do so much, but it also requires effective campaigning from other candidates. And we had 16 candidates who have mostly held their fire for a long time about the hateful rhetoric that comes out of Donald Trump's mouth. And listen, there's no catching up to the amount of media coverage that Donald Trump has been able to enjoy. And this late in the primary, I think groups did a commendable job trying to balance that footing, but they came up short in Indiana, and the road gets more challenging. But right now, what we're focused on is the down ballot races. What I'm concerned about is that if it does become Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton, that there won't be a Republican firewall in Congress to oppose Hillary Clinton's policies, because she would win that general election.
What do you say, Tom Marino, to Republicans who still will not get behind the now presumptive nominee, Donald Trump?
Well, there are going to be a few, but I think most are going to do it. But first of all, the issue is the will of the people. The delegates, in my opinion, should cast their delegate vote for whoever won the primary, and Donald Trump is the winner. And for individuals who want to go out there as delegates and say, I'm still not going to support Trump, then they're defeating the democratic process, because they represent the people who voted, the majority, and Donald Trump won, and they should take that representation to the floor in Cleveland.
So the RNC chair tweeted last night, it's time to unite against Hillary Clinton. Can you do that as a party? Will you do that as a party, Tom Marino?
We can and we will. We've done it in the past. We will do it again. It'll take a few weeks for the wounds to heal. But I see Senator Cruz coming out and supporting Donald Trump because he's a smart man. He knows he has a political career. And actually, I see Senator Cruz as a Supreme Court justice.
Ah, okay. Representative Tom Marino, U.S. Representative for Pennsylvania's 10th Congressional District, supporting Donald Trump for president. Representative, thank you so much for your time today.
You're very welcome.
Kelly O'Donnell, jump back in here. How are GOP leaders looking at all of this? Reluctantly embracing Donald Trump now, still watching with trepidation? What do you think?
Well, there's something known as the stages of grief, and I think that has been part of what the Republican Party establishment has experienced. There was denial, there was bargaining, and now slowly they're reaching acceptance. And by that I mean, as Rory mentioned, the down ballot races are critical for the future of the party. Will there be members of the Senate or the House who pay a price for Donald Trump being on the ticket? Will there be elections across the states, governorships in state legislatures? Will that have an impact? That's critically important for the future of the party, because it determines so much of how they can work with whoever is president, or how they can control who goes to Congress by having the dominance in a state legislature to determine the districts. It's very important and far-reaching.
A lot of listeners here want to get in on this conversation. Let's go to first to Dallas, Texas. Barry is on the line. Hi, Barry. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks for taking the call. Hey, my point is this. I'd like to hear a mea culpa out of the smarmy, snarky people over at National Review that got this thing so unbelievably wrong, fantastically wrong, that they missed a guy that was able to motivate millions of new voters to come to the party that they've always moaning and groaning about, not having enough people joining the party. Yeah, he gets millions of people to come into the party, and then he continues to snarky, disgusting belittlement of not only Trump, who's actually done a hell of a lot more than they have in their lives, but also his voters.
Mm. All
I left
right.
the Republican Party 8 years ago and switched to independent. Mm-hmm. I always vote Republican, but I switched to independent just for the sheer fact that the GOP is completely clueless.
All right, Barry, thank you. I'll turn to Eliana Johnson. That's your organization. Have the media, the pundits, got Trump wrong? What do you make of it?
Sure. Well, to address the criticism of National Review in particular and the publication's opposition to Trump, I would say that National Review has long been the flagship magazine for the conservative movement, which is different from the Republican Party. And the stance of the editors has been that Trump is not a conservative and therefore is not deserving of the magazine's support or the support of conservatives. And I think that's why you've seen him emerge from the nominating contest with a plurality of support rather than a majority of support. Conservatism, really, since Barry Goldwater's candidacy in 1964, has been the ideology underpinning the Republican Party. That has now changed with Donald Trump's nomination, but I think that goes to the root of National Review's opposition to his candidacy, and I think it remains to be seen whether conservatism as an ideology will remain as the underpinning of the Republican Party, or whether it will be replaced with Donald Trump's populism or something else entirely.
Rory Cooper, Republican strategist and advisor to the Never Trump PAC. I mean, Trump's long been underestimated. I think that's fair to say. But still, many people say he's not a true conservative. I mean, are there still rumblings from your perspective among your folks about some sort of third party candidate stepping in here? Is that even a possibility at this point?
Well, we don't know what that option might be, and that's why I don't think that anybody has to announce what they're going to do in November today until we see exactly what that ballot looks like. But to address part of what the caller was talking about too, which is this idea, you know, there are independents or Democrats who are upset with the Republican Party. That's their prerogative, but the Republican Party is not a Democratic organization. It's a party organization that is built on a platform. It's not merely a vessel for elections. And if somebody rises to the top in to the nomination that does not support that platform, is all over the map on the issue of life, is anti-free trade, is pro raising taxes, is inconsistent on the Second Amendment. You know, these are principal conservative positions that the Republican Party is built on, and people who care about that party and value the long-term need of that party are going to continue to speak out against somebody who threatens those principles and those values. And so, you know, I think, you know, one shining moment was the story of Tiananmen Square, of many young Republicans like myself were impacted by that moment where they saw the struggle for freedom and liberty so real and visceral, and became conservative because they wanted to see more freedom for people. Donald Trump looked at that and saw and sided with the Chinese government. So I think it's important for Republicans and conservatives to speak out against that type of rhetoric.
Sounds like the fighting continues. Never Trump continues. Rory Cooper joining us from Washington, advisor to the Never Trump PAC. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Let's go back to the phones. Andrew in Dayton, Ohio. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. How
yes.
are you guys doing?
Well, thank you. Go ahead.
Well, I'm a Bernie supporter. And, you know, no matter what happens with the nomination here, I think he has won in the hearts and minds of the American people. And I think he knows that. You know, before the election, I hadn't even heard of Bernie. And now he's got national recognition. Well, I should say international recognition. He even has the support of, you know, people all around the world. And I think, you know, in the future, what we're going to see, at least I hope, is I think we finally have the beginnings, possibly, of a viable third party here. You know, he can take all his recognition and money after this and really start something, you know, like a third party, get people interested in something, you know, besides Republicans, besides the Democrats, give people some sort of real alternative. And I think he could support a bunch of the candidates for Senate and Congress in the future and really get really start change from the ground up.
Interesting point, Andrew. Thank you so much for calling. Kelly O'Donnell, is Sanders staying in this to continue to shape a message, perhaps even a party platform?
Very much so. And from the earliest days, when Bernie Sanders was considering running for president. I cover him on the Hill. He was always talking about trying to move the party, less about himself, more about a broader message. You don't always see that in politics. It does seem to ring true with Bernie Sanders. What he hopes to do is by showing the energy, the dollar amounts that he has gotten from individual citizens, and the vote totals that he would bring into Philadelphia, where they'll have their convention, a chance to try to shape what the party will say is its message for the fall. What is in a platform? We talk about party platforms when it comes around to convention time. There is always sort of a sense that the party kind of regulars come together and say, this is what we're about, but a presidential campaign may veer in different directions. Bernie Sanders has already moved Hillary Clinton to the left. He has shown that there is an energized base out there to the left, and he wants some of those issues to be more a part of the conversation. College loans, beating up on Wall Street, looking at how power structures can affect working class people. Those are all themes that he has very effectively and aggressively prosecuted during his run and is shaping the party. So leveraging the success he's had into a larger message is a big part of what Bernie Sanders is about. Does he still want the nomination? Of course he does. The candidate always wants the nomination. But I think there are larger issues that he feels very good about.
Back to the phone, Cyrus in Austin, Texas. Hi, Cyrus. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Jane. Love the show. Look, I like Bernie. I've actually given him money. I like Hillary, too. I think Bernie should stay in the race until after the last votes in California. But his plan that's kind of more recently been articulated to force a contested convention at this stage, I think it's deeply irresponsible. The only thing that could lose the Dems the election at this point, I believe, is a contested convention. After Indiana, if Bernie were to win 100% of the pledged delegates, he would still fall short of winning the contested convention. Obviously, he's not going to win 100%. And the last time we had a real contested convention on the Democratic side, Reagan won 46 out of 50 states. And you know, finally, I'll just say, Bernie keeps pointing to the polls showing his performance against Trump. Dukakis was 20% ahead of George H.W. Bush at this point in 88, 20-plus percent ahead, and he ended up losing big. The polls, the general election polls right now don't mean anything until you've had, you know, at this point, $1 billion-plus dollars of attack ads against you. Then we can see who really is the stronger candidate. So I just beg anyone who cares about progressive policies to be really worried about this contested.
Cyrus, thank you so much. Eliana Johnson, jump back in here. I mean, pushing all the way to the convention, that's what sounds like Bernie Sanders is doing. Is he hurting Hillary Clinton at this point more than helping anything?
I think he's greatly damaging Hillary Clinton. I would just make two points. The first is that the Democratic primary process is really set up to favor an establishment candidate, and that's why I think a contested convention is very unlikely. The superdelegates are really stacked so much in favor of the establishment candidate, even though Bernie Sanders is lobbying them, they're very unlikely to hop over to support him. The Democratic primary process is set up so that essentially if the same thing occurred on the Republican side, it would have given Jeb Bush an enormous institutional advantage. And the second thing I would say is that the caller is absolutely right that general election polls taken before an election gets underway are very misleading, and the only thing that can really give a sense of what's likely to happen is how candidates perform once the campaign gets underway. I don't think he has anything to worry about because a contested convention is extremely unlikely given just as an institutional manner the way that the Democratic primary process is actually structured.
Kelly O'Donnell, what do you make of how do you see a Donald Trump-Hillary Clinton matchup?
Well, it will be one of the most watched campaigns, I think, in a long time, and it will probably bring some people who are not regular political viewers into the process to see this matchup. So interesting to have two candidates who have high negative polling ratings. That's unusual.
Right.
And to see how the combat will go forward. I think we've already seen the style of Donald Trump, a sort of scorched earth, go after your opponent as severely and viciously as possible and with branding. He was able to take down all of his Republican rivals with very simple messages that stuck with voters, from low energy Jeb to lying Ted, these pejorative names that he would put on his opponents that would identify some weakness he perceived in them as a candidate, and it stuck with voters. Expect that against Hillary Clinton. However, she has a very formidable army of people who have been working and preparing for this, and they can try to take apart Donald Trump and, in effect, embarrass him on areas that he is not yet familiar.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the new landscape of the presidential race after Indiana. And you can join the conversation. Given what we've already seen, are you ready for a rough ride ahead of the general election? Great panel this hour. Kelly O'Donnell, NBC News, Capitol Hill correspondent covering the 2016 race, and Ileana Johnson, Washington editor for the National Review. Last night at Trump Tower in New York City, presumptive GOP nominee Donald Trump set his sights on his likely rival in the general election, Hillary Clinton.
She doesn't understand trade. Her husband signed, perhaps in the history of the world, the single worst trade deal ever done. It's called NAFTA. And I was witness to the carnage.
Let's go to Stephen on that point in Windham, Connecticut. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, everybody. I'm a fan of all you ladies. You do a great job. I think HRC is in trouble because Donald runs to the left on her on so many issues. NAFTA, as you brought up, he's just hammered Wall Street through this whole thing, lagging wages, and then he's for single-payer health care. It just goes on. He's almost to the left of Bernie on some of this stuff. If he can stay away from these conspiracies, I don't think the guy's ever met a conspiracy he didn't like.
Stephen, thank you. Kelly O'Donnell, Donald Trump to the left of Hillary Clinton?
Well, surprisingly, when I have been on the trail at Bernie Sanders events and Donald Trump events, there are at times crossover voters who see some of what this caller is talking about, that Trump has identified with the working man, which is so ironic given his billionaire status and his Manhattan life and all of that. But the man born in Queens is somehow able to connect with those voters and talk about things like depressed wages and trade. He does not talk about universal health care in the current version of Donald Trump, but he does talk about the necessity for health care and improving some of the issues with what's commonly known as Obamacare. That's certainly popular among Republicans, but for those who might not identify with the Democratic Party but are more to the left on issues like this, there could be crossover for Donald Trump. We'll have to see how that plays out. That is certainly his campaign's intention, to try to peel away voters who in the past may have voted Democratic but are not loyal Democrats in the sense that you see in some parts of the country, but people whose issues may have more aligned with Democrats in the past. It's an interesting, unusual path, and we don't often see as many voters who are young who make that switch back and forth between Trump and Sanders, but some of the older workers who I see at events sometimes talk about that, and it is quite surprising compared to other types of campaign years to see that kind of a swing between two different candidates.
Here's an interview with BuzzFeed's politics podcast, No One Knows Anything. Yesterday, DNC Chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz speculated about what opportunities could arise for Democrats in states like Georgia and Arizona in the general election if Donald Trump is the Republican nominee.
With a nominee as extreme and as bigoted and as misogynist as Donald Trump is, then, you know, you not only have the opportunity for us to turn out voters that maybe would have sat on have been sitting on the sidelines in those minority communities that he's alienating, but also who we have the potential to win over from the Republican side, or who will stay home because they can't bring themselves to come out and vote for a nominee like him.
Ileana Johnson, the Associated Press reports actually today that Hillary Clinton is beginning to explore ways to woo Republicans who are turned off by Trump.
Yes, she's going to she's given the trouble that she has with some of her own party right now, particularly with working class whites and with some of the younger voters, Trump offers her an enormous opportunity given his own problems with his party. And picking up on what Kelly mentioned, there's a real irony in Trump getting to the left of Hillary Clinton on several issues and threatening her there, because he managed also to get to the right of Ted Cruz on an issue like immigration. And he's a curious enough candidate that ideologically that I think he'll offer Democrats, and what Republicans fear, he'll offer Democrats a lot of opportunities to pick up seats in typically Republican states and thereby really hurt Republican chances down ballot in red states like Georgia and throughout the South, and decimate the Republican Party, even in the House, where people have assumed that perhaps for decades Republicans would hold the House. And that's really going to be, for I think from here going forward, the chief concern of Republican strategists in Washington.
Here's Jill in Franconia, New Hampshire. Hi, Jill. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Yes.
I'm a Democrat, and I'm really excited about Hillary, but I have to admit that after last night, I'm pretty nervous about the general election. I just feel that the narrative now is that Trump's going to lose the general in a landslide, but the narrative about Trump has been proven wrong time after time. At first, his candidacy seemed nothing more than entertainment, and then he started winning, and the narrative was he can't break the 30% ceiling, and he'll be out as soon as the field narrows. And then we all had to learn about contested and brokered conventions speculate about white knight candidates. And now here we are. He's the presumptive nominee, and he's on course to get to 1237. And I just feel that the narrative is yet to be right about this dishonest and insecure bully. And I'd love to have the panel tell me I have nothing to worry about.
All right, Jill, thank you. Kelly O'Donnell, I mean, it is a good point. Do you think there are a lot of people out there voting for Trump, you know, who are just not admitting it? And might that make it difficult to predict what's going to happen in November?
There is an aspect of that. I have asked many people who attend Trump rallies if they have felt any discomfort, embarrassment, pushback from people in their lives, family members, neighbors, coworkers, about being a Trump supporter. And almost every time people say, yes, they do get some of that pushback. That could lead people to not be as comfortable talking about it, and therefore could give us a sort of mixed impression of what the electorate is really like. I think the Hillary Clinton campaign takes Donald Trump very seriously. They recognize the unpredictability he has shown in the primary season and that he can be formidable. Over time, we'll see where his weaknesses are in a head-to-head matchup with her. Her strengths for competency, knowledge, organization are considerable. But he has also been able to create a sort of unexpected phenomenon among voters that has outperformed all the conventional wisdom and expectations. And that's something to take seriously. And I think the Clinton campaign is doing that for sure.
Let's go to Peter in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Hello. One thing you might consider here is that Mr. Trump is very easily explainable in one respect, looking back on history in the 20s and 30s of the American past, back in the last century, and that is Mussolini and Joseph Goebbels in Germany, Father Coughlin, Joseph McCarthy, and it's known as propaganda and xenophobia. Look what Mr. Trump is doing. Walls to Mexico, this to immigrants, that and the other. And it is the ugliest campaign I have seen down here in my life. The language goes on, and it's almost like a sewer. You just want to drive the children away, except it's so vital that they understand that this is not what democracy is supposed to be about. And this idea that this democracy is going to be somehow protected by God or manifest destiny from all of this is absurd.
All right, Peter, I got your comment. Talking about an ugly campaign, I must bring up Trump's comments yesterday about Ted Cruz's father, that's suggesting he was somehow connected to the Kennedy assassination. I heard David Gergen call it the lowest blow in modern presidential politics, straight out of a McCarthy playbook. And then last night, Trump acknowledging Cruz quite differently. Here he is at Trump Tower after his win in Indiana.
Just so you understand, Ted Cruz, I don't know if he likes me or if he doesn't like me, but he is one hell of a competitor. He is a tough, smart guy. And he has got an amazing future. He's got an amazing future.
From his father was connected to a presidential assassination to he's got an amazing future, Kelly O'Donnell.
This is Trump trying to pivot to being what everyone is telling him he must be, and that is more presidential. Something extraordinary about Trump is his willingness, his almost fearlessness to say the unthinkable, to almost in a shock radio form, take something about an opponent and say it over and over and over again in almost a cartoonish exaggeration. The idea that a photo of Lee Harvey Oswald in 1963 in Cuba and a man next to him that Trump says could be the father of Ted Cruz based on a National Enquirer story, that's something we just don't see in politics. To take that and work it into the campaign on a critical day is really unheard of, and many people find it offensive and ridiculous and going too far. Underneath that, of course, attacking family members has generally been a no-no in politics. People get close to it all the time and then back away. Then you have Trump acknowledging the toughness of Cruz as a competitor. I think he actually believes that in terms of the organization and the discipline that Cruz has shown. But what do voters make of that sort of whipsaw in terms of what Trump says about someone else? That is very hard to really explain. And if it is purely just tactical that he'll say anything during a campaign season, it does give you pause to wonder how he would conduct himself when it's not a campaign, but it's governing. And that's a real question going forward.
Back to the phones to Austin, Texas. Hi, Jacob. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
Yes, I have 2 points to make. My first point is regarding what the other gentleman from Austin said earlier about responsibility towards Bernie Sanders, you know, possibly contesting the convention and carrying things up to the convention. I just wanted to mention that given what the polls have said for quite some time now, I mean, he was the only one that was beating Kasich in polls for the general election, and he's way above Hillary towards Trump. There's got to be some responsibility taken on the Democratic Party side, like the Democratic Convention and the superdelegates who've chosen to put all their weight behind Hillary. Because if she does indeed lose the general election, I think that they have a lot more responsibility than Bernie Sanders does, because I think Bernie Sanders is looking at things more in long term, thinking the status quo politics, if they continue as they are just not going to address any of these problems, no matter how much they say they're going to.
Jacob, thank you. Eliana Johnson, what's going on in Hillary Clinton's war room today?
Well, I absolutely think that there's some concern in Hillary Clinton's war room as to just how long this is going to go on, because what Bernie Sanders has succeeded in doing is really driving up her unfavorable numbers, which were already quite high. And she needs absolutely to pivot into general election mode and try to drive those numbers back down to appear as a likable, moderate, centrist candidate. And the longer he's in the race, he is pushing her further and further to the left. That is not where she needs to be in the general election. And he's also forcing her to say some things that are very damaging to her in a general election, including that, you know, he's not a Democrat, he's not really a Democrat, that his supporters aren't really a part of the party. Ultimately, what needs to happen is that she's going to need his endorsement, she's going to need his supporters, and the longer that this campaign goes without that happening, the more damage it does to her. And so what's happening in her war room is that they are frantically trying to figure out how to get him out of the race, and ultimately how to integrate his young, passionate supporters into her coalition.
Kelly O'Donnell, does Donald Trump go about the business now of choosing a vice president, a running mate? There was that New York Times piece over the weekend that many possible candidates for that position are really turning their backs at this point.
Well, sources tell me that process has begun, which includes reaching out to potential candidates to seek their permission to be vetted, and with that comes a very intensive experience of checking through all of their public record, their financial records, really sort of a dissection of all things that could potentially be an issue in a campaign. So the issue of will people accept that is a real question. At the same time, the vetting process allows the campaign and Trump himself to reach out to a potential running mate and find out would they be willing to serve. So they don't spring this on someone. There's a bit of time here to work through that. Trump himself has said he wants someone with political experience who can help build relationships on Capitol Hill so that he can work with Congress to avoid doing executive orders to the extent that President Obama has used that authority. And that's something that appeals to Republicans. Can he find a partner who can be a bridge builder? We'll have to see. Will he look for some sort of demographic balance? Would he consider a woman, someone from another part of the country? All of those sort of traditional how do you balance the ticket questions may not apply in a world that is run by Donald Trump. So we'll have to see. But we know that process is beginning.
Last quick thoughts here in our last minute. Eliana Johnson, this is going to be a rough few months on our way to November.
Absolutely. You know, when both candidates are generally disliked by the public and have high negative approval ratings, which is true of both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, the campaign season tends to be extraordinarily negative. The last time we saw something like this really was in 1988 when George H.W. Bush went up against Michael Dukakis, and I'm sure many listeners remember how that campaign went down with the ad about Willie Horton, and mm-hmm. It was an extraordinarily negative campaign, and we're in for something probably far worse than that between now and November.
Last 10 seconds, Callie O'Donnell, you get the last word. Put a final button on all this for us.
Unexpected things will continue to happen in campaign 2016.
Kelly O'Donnell, Capitol Hill correspondent for NBC News, covering the 2016 race. Kelly, great to have you on today. Thanks so much.
I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Eliana Johnson, Washington editor for the National Review. Eliana, thanks to you.
Thanks so much, Jane.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.